Welcome to the Globe Screen Podcast. Globe Screen is an international events company operating festivals and conferences for the entertainment industry in the US, UK, and France. Find us on Twitter at Globe Screen CONF. Our podcasts are not business as usual. Monthly guests are true artisans of the industry and responsible or involved in key creative departments, cinematography, editing, production design, casting, and VFX. The art and science behind movies is the footprint we intend to leave the listeners of each podcast. Episode 1, we had the pleasure of chatting with LA-based cinematographer Alonso Homs, whose wide-ranging credits include DPing on many films and working in the camera department of movies such as Blue Valentine and The Great Gatsby. Please enjoy. We'd like to welcome Alonso Homs to the Globe Screen Podcast. Welcome, Alonso.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
I guess tell us a little bit about yourself and about your work in the film and TV industry.
Absolutely. Well, I'm from Mexico originally. I moved to New York in 2004 to go to film school, and I went to the School of Visual Arts there. I was born and raised in Mexico. I lived in London for a year, but I realized I wanted to go to film school in New York. So that's why I went to the School of Visual Arts, and I studied cinematography. They have a program that you can select between directing, cinematography, producing, editing and producing. And I went for cinematography, and it was a good choice. From the beginning, I knew that cinematography is what I wanted to focus on, although I knew that it probably wasn't going to happen as far as work went without first getting like a technical job that I could start my career with. So I did 4 years of that program, graduated, went very well. It was really exciting at the time, and just being able to do what I enjoy doing. And I had a teacher there for a production class. His name is Mark Peterson, and he co-owned a company that bought the first two Red cameras ever.
Wow.
The name of the company is Of Hollywood. And they were like really forward thinking. I graduated in 2008. So it was at a time where digital wasn't, we knew that it was coming, but like the Red camera was seen as this like crazy marketing thing that, you know, it was never going to happen.
Right. Like Steven Soderbergh was shooting on the Red camera, but it wasn't automatically the norm, you know?
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. Soderbergh was one of the first ones. Peter Jackson shot something with it back then as well. But yeah, New York were one of the few companies who, you know, knew how to use it very well. It was really hard in the beginning. You know, you had to change the firmware every couple of days, and you'd really need it to be in the know to really have a stressless, you know, shoot. So anyway, so I became a technician with them. We called it Red Tech, Red Camera Tech. Although for the union, it was a DIT, a digital imaging technician was the position. And it was a really lucky time for me. It was great because I just happened to go in right in the kind of perfect timing. They needed technicians. I was out of school, and it was a great time because especially there were some projects where they needed the 4K, whether it was for like VFX purposes, or I remember doing, I worked on this documentary, Scorsese directed, called Public Speaking. And he wanted to do these long interviews, like 2-hour interviews without cutting. And so somebody said, hey, you should shoot on the Red camera. You can put hard drives on it and shoot forever. And so we did overnight, you know. And that was just like one of the first few projects I did as a professional. And like, you can only imagine how exciting that was to work with Scorsese and people at that level.
He's my favorite filmmaker.
Really? Yeah.
I've seen that documentary as well. It's about Fran Lebowitz, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Fran Lebowitz, exactly. So yeah, so it was really exciting time. I got to work with Doug Liman. I got to work with eventually Baz Luhrmann a couple of years later. But in general, it was just like a great springboard for me to just jump into my career. And so I was a digital imaging technician for about 5 years or so. The last couple of years of that, I started getting into 3D. So I became a stereographer. So that same company of Hollywood got the first, they were probably one of the first company in New York to buy these 3D rigs from Element Technica. I don't know if you're familiar with Element Technica, but they started making accessories for the Red camera, and eventually they got into 3D and stuff. Then they got bought out. But anyway, so we had these 3D rigs kind of laying around. There were going to be a couple movies that were going to come to New York. And I was always had a technical mind, but really creatively, I felt like that's where I wanted to be. And stereography kind of allowed me that. And I could see it back then already. Well, it's going to be a technical job because they're, you know, you need to know how to align the rig and a lot of the science behind what is good 3D or and healthy 3D, but also how do you help directors and cinematographers who've been working on a different medium for their whole lives, and how do you kind of help them in the process of using this new medium? So it was really exciting. So I started doing stereography, and in the beginning was like fashion films, and we did some stuff for the Discovery Channel because they were doing a lot of content in 3D back then. And yeah, it was also really exciting. And that's how I eventually got to meet Baz Luhrmann, because he knew he wanted to shoot The Great Gatsby in 3D. And he had met with some people in LA, but he was in New York. So somebody recommended him to of Hollywood. And we did a test shoot there. This must have been 2011, maybe 2010, I forget. But anyways, we did this test, and they went amazing. We shot in this mansion, one of the scenes from the movie with Leo DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire acting in it. And it was really, really an amazing experience. So I was the stereographer in the end. I ended up being the stereographer for the movie, which was a whole other incredible thing. I was in Australia for about 7 months or so. I even got to go back and work on the depth, the DI, so to speak, kind of adjusting the 3D of it.
I think that's pretty incredible that just a couple of years out of film school, you're working with directors of that caliber, like Scorsese and Baz Luhrmann and Doug Liman. Those are, you know, some pretty heavy hitting names there.
Absolutely. I couldn't believe it. There was something about it. Yeah, I just couldn't believe it. And because I was pretty, from the beginning, from film school, I was really into older films, 50s, 60s, 70s. And so, you know, I knew a couple of them. I mean, Scorsese obviously had been doing films since then, but Doug Liman and Baz Luhrmann hadn't. So it wasn't necessarily my wheelhouse. I knew how important they were, of course, and I knew their movies and loved their movies. But there was something about it, I just couldn't believe it. It just felt like I didn't almost belong there, you know. It was so crazy to watch them work, because they were so, for in my mind, they were so successful. Yeah, and I just thought they would be either kind of mean or very specific about their process in certain ways, and I just found them to be like very focused, very humble, very nice people who just knew what they wanted, and they had an amazing crew around them, and in a way kind of simplified filmmaking to me. Like I realized, once you take the ego out of it when you can, it can be a really special thing. So yeah, so that was the first few years of my career. So that was really, really crazy.
That's amazing.
And then, so that was DITing and being a stereographer. Then I started shooting here and there. Again, I had gone to school for cinematography. So I went back to New York after being in Australia for a couple of years, and I started my own production company with a couple partners, and we were just going to do commercial stuff. Like in my mind, I knew that I had to get into the creative side of things even further. It was a bit of a risk because I knew that I was coming from these huge projects to just producing my own little things, and it'd be challenging, but we also got lucky. We're really working really hard to get some clients and stuff. And in the end, it was doing really well. We were doing mostly branded content. It was when branded content started.
Yeah.
kind of as native advertising, 2013 or 14. And yeah, that's why I switched to the production company and I started shooting. I just essentially started hiring myself. I would co-produce all these commercials and whatever, and I would just hire myself.
Nice.
And it went well. I think in the end it was a good move. It felt like taking a couple of steps back because of the scale of the projects, but I was also always very scared of getting stuck in a technical job that I didn't enjoy as much, you know.
Well, I think that's what's interesting about looking at your IMDb resume, that it's not just, you know, just cinematography, or you've had an eclectic sort of background in working in different facets of film. I saw that you even worked on the movie Half Nelson that came out in the mid-2000s.
Yeah.
And that was an interesting film.
As an art intern. Yeah, that was crazy. Yeah. That's true. I forgot about that. I find that it helps so much, you know, to just do as many jobs as you can. You understand, like, Half Nelson was that movie. I don't know if you've, for those who haven't seen it, it's about a teacher in Brooklyn. And
who
it was
like
Ryan Gosling's first big role, I think, if I remember correctly.
He started doing some roles. He did the movie The Believer that he starred in. And that, but it was definitely when he was starting to make a name for himself.
I think
he was doing the United States of Leland. Like, he was definitely starting to progress.
Right, exactly. So anyways, it was a small indie, but it had a budget, of course, you know. We were in the school for all these weeks and all this stuff. And yeah, so I was just the art intern. I was painting walls and making banners and all this stuff. And until this day, I still, anytime I'm working with the art department or like just to be able to understand what their day to day is and all that is so helpful to, you know, work better with people.
Oh,
so
yeah,
I kind of done a bit of everything, and that's really helped me, I think.
And even James Cameron, I'm not sure if you're aware, he started off as the art department on Roger Corman B movies.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And he started to make a name for himself because he really just threw himself so hard into the work that he ended up becoming the production designer of one of the projects. And somebody was like, hey, maybe this guy could direct a movie. They had him directing a movie called Piranha 2, which was sort of botched from the beginning because I guess it was an Italian film director that really wanted to take over the project. He just needed an American name, but he had like a bad reputation and he would kick people off the project and sort of hijack it. And then that's how he got his start, kind of.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
I mean, that I guess it makes sense. I know a lot of good directors started as editors. I think that I find that one of the best paths for really good directors. It is just so helpful.
Yeah, my background.
How about
you? My background.
Tell me about you.
My background isn't as an editor. Actually, I started off as an editor, and I agree that it's really helpful for directing because I found that my background as an editor really helped me understand what's the end result supposed to look like. You know, if you could sort of edit in your mind a little bit, that definitely is a leg up in terms of what you need to get on the day of shooting. You know, and then
totally. Yeah. That's something that has happened to me as well. As I had my production company, I started producing, like I said, as well. And that meant just taking it. It was a bit of a process to go from like a crew member who only would think about the day to day in a production sense to really think big picture and to think of how the every decision, you know, makes such a difference and stuff like that, where I started shooting differently, you know, and I started kind of scheduling my time while we were shooting in a so much smarter way because I could see it all from afar, you know, I had more perspective, and that's something that has helped me so much. It's so easy to get stressed in like the little details of the day and the moment. And then ultimately, you know, none of that matters 2 months later when you're editing.
That's so true. And I was just going to ask you about that, I think that's so cool that as a cinematographer, you also have producing experience because then it gives you a better understanding of just like you mentioned, scheduling and, you know, how many shots you might need to actually cover in a day. And, you know, instead of, hey, we're just spending 3-4 hours lighting this one shot and then forgetting everything else on the shot list.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that was, I guess, another thing that I learned from Mark Peterson, who owned that company of Hollywood, because he was all about using the latest technology, the one that feels like it's going to break any moment or it might not work, but like this whatever, you know, product just came out and it allows us to do whatever thing. So he would be all about using new technology, but also finding like having a crew that would modify, you know, depending on what we were shooting, and like would wear multiple hats, and all about efficiency. And I learned a lot that way too, of like, how do you, even when you have less money and lower budget, how do you still use the tools that you need that will make it all easier? And still, you know, not be wasting money in other places.
So, right. Efficiency is so important, especially on independent films. And I mean, I guess every, like even studio films, you know, everything is, time is, you know how it is. It's a race against time when you're on set.
Exactly.
So I guess, what are you currently working on? What are you currently shooting?
Yeah, good question. This year has been so crazy for all of us, but
literally everyone in the world.
yeah. So it was a lot about not shooting and more, you know, kind of reconnecting with movies and TV shows and that I loved for some inspiration. But then, because I was doing commercials mostly last year and the year before, and I do these also branded content, digital stuff, where we travel and we'll do like a small team, but we'll, you know, we'll do like nicer cameras and lenses and just less, a smaller crew, but kind of higher production value stuff. And we get to travel and stuff. So I've been doing a lot of that in the last year or two. But then this year I got connected with a friend of mine who was directing his first feature for Lifetime. Or I should say for Mar Vista is the studio producing it. And he hired me to DP, and I hadn't shot a feature in years, in like 7 years or so. So I was like, well, hell, you know, what am I doing? What else am I doing in this pandemic? Let's go to Oklahoma and shoot this movie. So, but the schedule was crazy because they do these movies in like 12 days.
Wow.
You can imagine.
Yeah.
And it's mostly one camera. We did two cameras for a few days, but and it was two movies back to back. So the producer was also going to direct a movie right after that with a week in between. So we basically spent 6 weeks in Oklahoma, and yeah, we shot these two features. And was really, really exciting for me because, I mean, after being kind of stuck at home for so many months, but also doing a lot of the commercial stuff in the past couple of years, you get to, you know, use all the new toys and stuff like that. But That's really cool. Look and the vibe, you know, it's not always as cinematic as, of course, a movie. So yeah, that was really exciting just to get back on set in that way and to like get to work with the same group of people for multiple weeks. And it was really exciting. So yeah, those are, the genre is thriller, both of them. Which is fun for me too, because, you know, I get to play around with lighting and color contrast, which is big for me. And
sure.
It was really, really exciting.
That's really cool,
and we finished them on time and somehow. And it was also a great exercise in just lighting very fast. You know, when you're shooting like 10 pages a day, yeah, there's, you know, you have to be very strategic about how you light every scene, because you won't really get any time to tweak in between, you know. So kind of exercising that muscle and be really strategic with the lighting and also just letting, you know, some things go, especially that in commercials you'd always want to light it so high key, and to really get to let, you know, oh, half of her face is just totally black, you know, and dark, and it works for the genre. But and also, you know, when you have too much time to work on something, like it happens in commercials all the time. I'm sure you have that experience as well, where you can just really work a frame to death, and you start tweaking all the stuff that doesn't matter, and you actually start making it worse, you know.
So, right, I've seen that.
You know, you're working on too much, and now it's, you know, 15 people chiming in, and is the cheese on the sandwich melted enough, and is the steam, like, you know, stuff that, you know, for people like us, it just doesn't matter as much. If the creative is there, and that's really what's more important to me.
True, man. There's a point of diminishing returns.
It is. It's such a crazy thing to jiggle those two worlds. How about you? Do you do mostly feature stuff or commercial stuff?
So I released my first feature film. It's called The Trouble. It's on Amazon, and that was nice. Last year, and we shot that super, super low budget, you know, kind of guerrilla style. And I have a close collaboration with my cinematographer. His name is Alex Gray, and we nice. Shoot actually a lot of projects together in general, and we have a really close working relationship in terms of, like, even if I'm not sleeping, like, I'll drive around so I don't wake up my wife and kids, and then I'll call up Alex and we'll have like a deeply technical conversation at like 2 o'clock in the morning about, you know, like how we want our next film to look, you know.
Nice.
And so nice. You know, so now
it's exciting to have a good collaborator. Is so important, isn't it, to the whole?
Oh man, it is so important. Yeah, it's great. I always kind of longed for that, you know, in the early days of kind of getting started, because I really didn't know anybody and I didn't go to a traditional film school. And you know, I started a production company, and it was at first was, you know, just kind of, I'd already finished college, so I have an unusual route to getting into the industry. Although I did actually was always interested in film, and in fact I also took classes at the School of Visual Arts when I was in high school. Nice. On the weekends I would take directing courses, and when I was in high school.
That's awesome.
But for whatever reason I didn't pursue it immediately after high school. And I think the reason was actually because the 16-year-old me, when I learned about how much hard work filmmaking entails, I was actually, the 16-year-old me was daunted by it. I was like, oh, okay, I love watching movies, but this is incredibly hard work. But then, of course, you get out into the real world, and I started my own business. I'm like, well, everything worth pursuing is really hard work, so you might as well gravitate toward the thing that you love to do. And so then that's why I ended up getting back into film.
Nice. Yeah, that another thing that happened to me, I remember when I was young, was taking these directing classes, and I just remember thinking, like, I don't have enough life experience to be, you know, writing and making these films about, you know, big life drama, you know, or whatever it might be. Just, I haven't lived enough, you know, I haven't had enough experiences of my own. And 15 years later, finally starting to brew, like, okay, I've, you know, and I'll probably think the same thing in 20 years, 30 years, you know.
Well, I'm actually happy you say that, Alonso, because I think that's my only, sometimes when I beat myself up, I'm like, well, why didn't I immediately go to film school? Why did I wait till I was 27 to make my first short film? But then sometimes I also think, I'm like, well, I guess the one advantage that I do have versus a kid that just finished NYU film school or something, I'm like, I did sort of taste life by the time I was 27. I really had a lot of experience in other ways, you know.
There you go. And I think it's so valuable. I mean, sometimes I think of, like, oof, if our industry did end up disappearing, like, what the hell would I do? I really know nothing else but film, you know. I can cook here and there or whatever. Maybe I would work at a restaurant. But when your knowledge is so specific to this one industry, and it is very cool to talk to people who, you know, who just had a different life at some point before their film career, and they I find that often the best crew members had, you know, valuable life experience before that. And so I think you did the right thing. I feel lucky that I've been able to do what I love to do, you know, my whole career, but I also sometimes wish, yeah, I had a little more life experience in other places. So yeah.
Did you come from a family? Like, I know you grew up in Mexico, and did you come from a family that was like into the arts or into, you know?
Yeah, interesting. Not really. I mean, my dad is a businessman and my mom's a psychologist. So neither of them are in the arts. My mom was, being a psychologist, she was always very open to me, you know, doing whatever I wanted. And she was interested, as in, like, you know, we would watch French films when I was young. And it's not like she was watching only commercial stuff or she didn't care. She had an eye for it. She just didn't do it. And nobody else in my family, really. Nobody was in the business. So, and that's something that I remember my dad telling me since I went to school, like, hey, the only thing I know about the film business is you need to know somebody. Otherwise, it's really hard to be successful.
Yeah.
And so if you're going to do this, you're going to do this alone, and you're going to have to, like, make your own path. And I said, yeah, I'll try it. Let's do it. Why not? But it was a hard decision for that alone, you know, sure, because for whatever reason, my dad knew that, and really put that in my head. But yeah, then you just, you know, if you're at the right place at the right time and you work really hard and put a lot of effort and connecting with people and establishing work relationships, it all does unravel. It is really fascinating for me to think back to the first jobs I got and how they all really come from the same branch of a relationship. Really, most of the important stuff for me, and really most people I've ever worked with branch out of film school, you know. Yeah. Even 15 years later, you know, a couple of people that I met through other jobs that I got through people through film school, you know. So yeah, it's interesting how, I can't imagine for you going into an industry kind of blind and again without the relationships and without the benefit of, like, graduating with 100 other people, you know.
It's true. I think I kind of doubled down on just joining different organizations. For instance, I became a member of the Bronx Filmmakers Collective at some point. Oh, nice. Which is a great group of, you know, hardworking filmmakers from the Bronx that also, you know, that's where I'm originally from. And nice. An area traditionally where it's, you know, very outside of Hollywood, you know, so it's not like a lot of those filmmakers had some sort of underlying connections, but just a desire to tell stories, really. And, you know, then I was also just attending film festivals. Like, I would go to, I attended Sundance a couple of years just to watch movies. You know, I love movies. And then I found that, oh, like, well, attending film festivals, everybody's usually pretty friendly there and pretty open about, you know, just exchanging numbers or keeping in touch with each other. Right. So I just started to make contacts by just trying to, like, go out there and meet people and like-minded people. And actually, I did partner up with a couple of other guys when I started my production company, Alphabet City Films. And one of them had went to NYU Film School. And my producer partner, George Rudai, he went to the Brooklyn College of Film. And in the early days, they used to sort of chew me out because they went to film school. They'd be like, oh, Zeph, this is like this and this is like that. And then I just became so into it, reading every sort of book imaginable, just really pushing myself. And then at a certain point, they were like, okay, you didn't need to go to film school. Like, you know, you even know more than us now.
Right. So. Nah, that's nice. It must have felt nice to be like, yeah, got you guys.
Yeah, it did feel good that at least they were giving me the kind of acknowledgement, like, okay, you're good. You didn't have to, you know, go that route. So I don't have a strong opinion one way or the other. I think film school is great. You know, if I could go back, of course I would have went. But I also think if you don't go, then, you know, just find other ways to supplement that knowledge and then just be even more proactive about meeting people, like-minded people.
That's exactly right. I think it's the key. If you're the kind of person who doesn't mind, you know, socializing and networking independently from a school, then I think it's even better. I mean, because a lot of the valuable stuff you learn, it's either from movies or from working on set, and you can watch movies, you know, virtually any movie now for very little, and working on set, you can also, if you start out as a PA or something, you know, you can really learn so much and save all that tuition money, you know, as long as you're willing to and able to kind of network outside of it.
Yeah. And actually, from attending the Globe Screen conferences, funny enough, I started seeing different people that I even knew there, including a guy named Brian, who was a member of the Bronx Filmmakers Collective. And, you know, and then I found that, you know, a lot of times when you're attending these sort of events and people are pretty receptive to talking to each other. They're there usually to meet people. So, I mean, I find more people that are kind of friendly enough to have a chat or a conversation with you respectfully about the craft, you know, versus people that are standoffish and don't want to be bothered. So, you know, I think it's good. Hopefully, we'll get back on track in the world, you know, having more in-person yeah. events and also actual theatrical screenings as well, because I think that's such an important part of our industry, is that communal way of watching films themselves.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. Isn't it crazy how while I was in Oklahoma, I got to go to the movies because I hadn't here in LA since March.
Sure.
And I would go maybe once a week, you know, something like that. But
yeah.
So I got to go see Tenet. And
How was that?
It was exciting. Yeah, it was good. You know, I guess I really like some of his other movies better. I think it's the science is quite complicated, and but visually, you know, they do some stuff that he does so much practically that it's really, you can tell, you know, the lack of VFX in the best of ways. So that's what I admire about him.
Yeah, I admire his that team, as well.
The most. Effect. Yeah, but yeah, you know, the movie's not necessarily my cup of tea, but visually, yeah, really, really amazing. So, and just the experience of, you know, being in a theater again. I went to one where they were trying to do social distancing, leaving every other row empty, and it was really only a handful of us in the theater, in this big theater. I just miss going to the movies.
I miss it as well. So I guess, you know, thinking about Christopher Nolan, who's been a very passionate proponent of shooting film on film itself versus digital. What's your view on the ongoing debate about shooting on film versus digital?
Oof. It's a complicated issue for me because while I was in film school, the old, like I was saying, the movies of the 50s, 60s, 70s were so important to me and really most of my inspiration as I learned the craft. So with that came a lot of the kind of glorifying a lot of the people that worked back then and that are known to be like the cinematographers on film in particular, the masters, you know, Gordon Willis and Owen Roizman and Laszlo yeah. Kovacs and people like that.
All legendary DPs.
Yeah. And I loved their work and I would read about, you know, especially Gordon Willis's like experimentation in the lab and all that stuff was really fascinating for me. But then what really gave me my career was digital cameras. You know, the only reason why I've kind of made a career in it because of the Red camera. Sounds crazy, you know, but maybe I'm sure I would have found another way out. And if I worked on films that shot on film only, then I'd probably be saying the opposite thing. But in short, it's like, it's been the craziest revolution, you know, that I've seen, again, because I graduated right as digital cinema started becoming a thing, where I've seen it develop to such levels that it's really unbelievable. Stuff we wouldn't have guessed even just 15 years ago of how good this cinema cameras, digital cinema cameras look like now.
Is it difficult for you certain times to tell what's shot on film versus digital?
I think I could probably tell most of the time, but that's, I think, at the core of the argument for me. It's
you're looking at more like you could tell most of the time, but you're looking at very now specific things like, oh, well, I could tell because of the grain pattern here, right, is like that,
right,
versus,
right,
you know, like an such an obvious difference.
Right. I mean, it's gotten really to a point where, I mean, there's a couple different, a few instances in which, you know, film will really shine against digital. But for the most part, I think of it, I kind of think of it as like the grandmother test, you know, like if, and as that, I mean, anybody that's not in our business, and which is like, would they really be able to tell the difference? Like, you can shoot beautiful stuff on digital, unquestionably, right? So you don't need to shoot on film to shoot stuff that's beautiful, you know. And for the most part, the vast majority population of the world, would they be able to tell the difference? Not really, you know. So what really matters, you know, is should I be so self-absorbed as a DP that I should really fight for this thing that it's such a niche thing that only people that do what I do can fully appreciate? I don't think so. I think film is for everybody, you know, and if it's going to mean, I don't know, allowing, reallocating the budget in a different way and getting more for our department, or again, this is kind of more my producer mind speaking, but I think that the decisions that make film beautiful, or imagery, you know, cinema beautiful, for the most part, are not have anything to do with the actual format that you shoot. You know, you can shoot 16mm or 35 or digital and really create amazing stuff anyways.
I agree.
So that's kind of where I've landed. Like, I mean, would I love to shoot something, some experimental thing or some cool fashion thing on film in the desert? Yeah, I would love to, but for the most part, most of the projects I work on really makes most sense to shoot digital, and I don't think we should be so. I really think we get lost in our kind of in our heads and our process too much, and that's when you can really dissect something to death, and you lose that perspective of what makes something good. It's typically the bigger decisions.
It's so true.
You know, and so that's kind of where I am.
That's my thoughts as well, and I've been pretty vocal about that. I'm very pro digital, and I love film. I respect it immensely, and I would love to direct a film like on film itself. You know, maybe even just for the sake of then actually feeling like a proper filmmaker.
Right.
However, I will say that one reason that I'm very pro digital is that I feel like it's democratized the filmmaking process in terms of making it more accessible for people that would just never have been able to get into filmmaking if it wasn't for that. And I could definitely speak for a lot of the folks at the Bronx Filmmakers Collective, for instance, or, you know, even certain, like, you know, even certain sorts of people that are coming from like sort of working class backgrounds that they just would not have been able to afford shooting and developing on 35mm film.
Totally, exactly. I know we were previously talking about the Florida Project as a movie that we both love, but I think, I don't know too much about Sean Baker, the director, but I know that he shot Tangerine on an iPhone, and in my mind, it's people like that are really can think so out of the box that they're going to bring new things to our industry on a creative end, you know, not so much on a technical end, but
absolutely. Yeah. And he started off very sort of guerrilla style, making, you know, films in New York City, like shot on, I think, like mini DV cameras and things like that, and just kept progressing. And, you know, so I really admire him. And I mentioned the other day when we were talking, I happen to have met him at an IFP event, and very nice guy. So it's always good to find that people whose work you admire are also just kind human beings. So
yeah, that's nice. That's so nice to hear. It's so cool you got to meet him. I think he's such an admirable filmmaker.
Speaking of the Florida Project, I guess I want to find out, like, what sort of influences, like, I really want to like tap into like your cinematic influences, like who really inspired you to get into film and to become a cinematographer. I mean, you mentioned Gordon Willis, who was outstanding, shot The Godfather, and Owen Roizman, that shot The French Connection, if I'm not mistaken, which is
one
of my favorite films.
It's so for me, back in film school, those were the guys I was looking at the most. Yeah, Gordon Willis, Owen Roisman, Laszlo Kovacs. I, in particular with lighting, I think my first attraction to cinematography was through lighting, less than camera. It's something that just, for whatever reason, came really natural to me. And I saw these, it's a kind of a hard thing to learn really fast. You know, we take all these lighting classes in film school. And some people just could not get it, you know, could not light a scene to save their lives. And I kind of noticed quickly, like, oh, for whatever reason, this comes easy to me. I can't draw to save my life. I can't, you know, paint it. There's stuff that anything with my hands, it's not like I'm making stuff where that doesn't really come easy, but for whatever reason, lighting did. So I focused more on that. Yeah. What I really gravitated towards was like traditional, but very high quality lighting and camera positioning. But as time went on and as I've been, you know, working in the industry more and more, I've kind of realized I just like very natural lighting. You know, I've the more I shoot, the more I try to use less lights, you know, as much as I can to really, I have this Australian friend I worked with on The Great Gatsby who I remember him telling on some scout, like, the American DPs will show up to the location for a scout and will be asking, like, figuring out with the gaffer where they're going to put the lights. Whereas like the European DPs would show up to Australia, Asian DPs as well, they would be thinking about really trying to understand how the light would develop throughout the day in that particular location, you know. That's, and both are, of course, can get you great results. But that's something that how I've been adapting. Like, I find beauty in like specific lighting conditions that happen naturally, that, you know, it requires taking some risks. Of course, if you're lighting with natural light and it's the kind of day with passing clouds and you have very little time, it's probably not going to work if it's going to keep getting
so
cloudy, you know, stuff like that. But in general, it's more the natural lighting. And so the people in kind of recently cinematography that I particularly like are movies like The Square. Ruben Östlund's, I don't know if I'm saying his name.
That one, the Cannes Film Festival a few years ago.
Yeah, 2017. Of a few years ago. Yeah. Same with The Lobster, Yorgos Lanthimos.
Yes, I've seen The Lobster.
Films, like, they do a great job at presenting the world they're creating in, like, a very elevated way, but it's, but the contrast isn't crazy, you know? It's all, they kind of let the light pouring from the windows, and they, especially Lanthimos, uses longer lenses on his wide shots, you know, that I really love. And as far as natural light goes, of course, Chivo Lubezki, who, me being Mexican, I have a particular kind of admiration for him. And he's also one, although he, of course, uses like white lenses almost exclusively, his understanding for the natural light, I think, is the best out of anybody that I, as far as I understand.
Nice. And I'm guessing that you're a big fan of, or like you believe in motivated lighting.
Yeah, exactly. Motivated lighting. And I'm the kind of DP who's like thinking about coverage and, is this really the best possible place for the camera to be to tell the story or whatever the character is going through. Like, I'm not the kind of DP who is thinking of like the single frame that's the coolest possible frame, or is like, is going to get particularly excited to use this new lenses, or like, what really gets me excited is to work with the directors on set and figuring out the best way to tell the story. I was listening to a podcast actually with Caleb Deschanel the other day. He did the movies that love us. That movies that made us. Is that the name of it? I think. But anyways, he was talking about the DP really being like the director's right hand in most of his job. You know, the director's answering, he was saying, like 10 million questions a day. The DP's maybe only asking a million questions a day, but still so much of how you're going to capture and tell the story is where you're going to put the camera and the camera movement and the lighting. And that's how I really like to think.
That's so important, by the way, man. So I'm so happy to hear you say that, because I think, I don't want to say that's a lost art, but I feel like that's something that was really understood by those great DPs that you mentioned of the past, that it wasn't just about, hey, what's the coolest looking shot, or what's going to look awesome for my demo reel. It was really about, well, how do we visually tell this story so it's the most impactful, sort of that it's really serving the story, the like cinematography tied into the story of the film itself. To me, that's what a great DP is. Not somebody that's like, oh, well, I don't care if it's a good movie or bad movie, I'm just going to make it look great, you know?
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's why, I mean, movies that I associate as being the most beautiful are not only most beautiful visually, but they interconnect with what the director was trying to do. Like movies like Manhattan, to me, you know, one of the most beautiful. Like it's very careful composition and the black and white and the lighting really
shot that, right?
Stunning, huh?
Was that Gordon Willis?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
he did, I think, 7 or 8 movies with Woody Allen. I think most of the ones I like in the 70s in particular with Gordon Willis, Annie Hall as well, and Interiors, which was like Woody Allen's kind of homage to Bergman. It was really Bergman-like, but really beautiful. So yeah, to me, it's like lighting faces and like really get in there and reading the characters. Motivation or reaction to something, or focusing on the right thing. Like that's really what's going to get me more excited. And yeah, so movies like that are example of that, like Manhattan and Annie Hall. There's so much about the people, you know, and who you're choosing to show what moment. That's really the most important to me. So yeah, those are combination of influences. I think... the other thing I really love is musicals in general. This is something that I don't fully understand why, but I think when I was a teenager, it was the first movies that I remember watching, Singing in the Rain, for example, when I was like 14, and watching it twice immediately. You know, as soon as it finished, I just watched it again immediately. Wow. 'Cause I was just couldn't get my eyes off of it. It was so, and it was so Hollywood and so colorful and so large and scale, and in such a different way from what I was seeing growing up in the 80s and 90s, that I think I just associated that grandness, vastness with the musical. So then I got into Jacques Demy, who's this French director. I don't know if you know, but he did The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. Is maybe his most well-known film. He did The Young Girls of Rochefort as well. But he was trying, in the 60s, he was making musicals in French, but with a big influence on Hollywood musicals of the 30s, 40s, and 50s. So he's not necessarily an influence to me, because I haven't really gotten a chance to work on anything that is in that style. But he was, you know, all about color and same, like a very careful composition. He would do these crazy, especially in The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, this incredible wallpapers that were perfectly coordinated with the wardrobe and just the way he would reveal the third wall in the room, right, as a different character that walked in with the right wardrobe that complemented that back wall, you know, just so visually minded, and then at the same time like a devastating story that just like gave you just really impactful from kind of every direction. So that would be another big, again, not necessarily influence, but I guess some filmmaker that really excites me.
Yeah, you appreciate their work.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. How about you? Who are your...
Well, I love so many films. I'm a Scorsese fanatic. I love a lot of French films from you know, the 60s, like, you know, François Truffaut and, you know, that sort of thing. I just love the fact that how they pushed the envelope, and, you know, films from the 70s. You know, it really becomes hard to narrow it down, but I have such a deep respect for cinematography, like, you know, that so I really respect what you as DPs bring to the table, and, you know, and so that's why I have such a close working relationship with my own cinematographer, Alex Gray, and, you know, because it really becomes, we're having constant conversations of, well, what could we do to push the envelope in our own storytelling ambitions, you know, and so it's a constant sort of constant thing. I would say my favorite film, I love Stanley Kubrick, you know, he's one of my favorite filmmakers.
Absolutely.
And he's somebody that certainly put a lot of thought into how his movies would look.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I'd say 2001 Space Odyssey is probably after all those musicals. When I was a teenager, that was another one that I remember watching and like couldn't stop thinking about. I still barely understand it, you know.
You know, I watched
it 20 times.
I feel like I only understood it when I saw it on the big screen. Like, I tried to watch it so many times. I remember watching in Earth Science when I was in the seventh grade. My teacher was like, oh you guys got to watch this amazing movie called 2001 A Space Odyssey. And I just remember the seventh grade me watching it on this little screen in science class, and I'm like, what? just totally checked out. And until tried watching it, just couldn't really connect with it. And then it wasn't until I saw it at the IFC Center when they were doing like the 50-year anniversary a few years ago of the film, where I saw it on a giant screen, that I'm like, wow, this movie was so far ahead of its time. It's incredible. And I only fully appreciated the entire scope of the film from watching it on a screen that was much bigger than myself, and just being totally immersed in the film. And I felt like I really sort of connected with everything that was going on.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's so much stuff happening. You kind of need to see it all on the big screen to fully take it in. I agree. Maybe that remains as like the film I'll always be shocked by, and, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I was totally blown away. Wow, Kubrick made this 50 years ago, and it still looks amazing.
Yeah, you know, and he will forever. I mean, that's the one thing about, not the one thing, but one thing I forgot in that film conversation is like, it is true that digital cameras have gotten so incredibly better, but they are still, in particular as it comes to resolution, like a machine of their time, you know. I think we'll get to a point maybe in a couple of years where, like, you know, we're shooting everything in 8K or whatever it might be, and we'll be able to keep that as a standard for years to come. But yeah, there's just no, obviously nothing up until now has proven to capture, especially in a way that can be shown again and again, you know, at a scale that film does. You know, that is something that I definitely would have been mad if he had shot that on digital back then. But you know, you look at films shot on digital 15 years ago and you're like, oh, a bit of a shame. Cameras weren't quite there yet. And
I know what you mean. That's how I feel about Michael Mann's Public Enemy. I was like, why did he shoot that on digital? I was like, especially since it's a film about the 1930s. And I was like, it was so distracting to me that he shot that on digital. I mean, I feel less that way about Collateral with Tom Cruise. Right. And I'm a big fan of Michael Mann. I think he's like a really nice. Great filmmaker.
Yeah, I think he did. Yeah, Collateral, I think he did because he wanted shoot a lot of
nighttime in LA.
Didn't want to light the night exteriors, right? A lot, and he wanted like a high sensitivity.
Right.
But yeah, it's so noisy. And
yeah, that's true. You know what? I haven't seen Collateral in a number of years. I mean, I love the film, but I want to see how I feel about the way it looks today by today's standards, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. That was another thing that I got lucky. I should have mentioned. I did have a teacher in school who was my mentor, Chris Newman, who was a legendary sound mixer from a lot of these films I've been mentioning. He was the sound mixer on The Exorcist and The Godfather and all the Godfather movies and English Patient and all this.
That's classics. Amazing.
Yeah, incredible resume. And he... I got a chance to, he was still working while we were in school. He did one of the last films he worked on was Sidney Lumet's Before the Devil Knows You're Dead.
Oh yeah. With, Ethan Hawke and Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Good memory.
Yeah.
I think it's a great film. So my mentor was the sound, mixer on that. And he talked to the DP, see if I could come be a guest on the movie, just watch the DP work for a week. The DP's name is Ron Fortunato. And he was another one that I really only interacted with him that week, but, and I should have kept in touch. I'm the worst at that. But he was not only such a great guy, but really good. I remember back then, like he was making the best of video. Back in 2006,
I think the movie came out.
Maybe 2006. He was really making the best of it. I learned a lot about how to like light it and because he was using this gaffer he'd been working with for decades, who was like an old fashioned gaffer. Who had been working on Lumet movies for years. And his focus was like, how do I make this just look as much as like film as possible, you know?
Yeah.
He did a great job. And he had a legendary DIT, one of the guys who'd like started the DIT role almost in a way in New York, who explained to me a lot about how the digital cameras had evolved even from, you know, the mid 90s through the mid 2000s and in what way, and really explain like the role of the digital imaging technician, who now, if you work on any low budget, anything, they just call the DIT, the data manager, you know, who's really just right. Downloading all the footage and backing it up. And on big movies and back then it was really such a, the DIT was such an important part of the look of the film, especially when you were baking in a lot of the look into, you know, whatever you were filming, if it was to tape or whatever else. And they were really coloring before it got baked in. And so it was like part of the lab, you know, right on set. And now, you know, of course you can adjust stuff so much in post that, the ITs have become to a degree a little less important,
that's fascinating to just understand that. And you know, for sure it's something I've always also been interested in and just curious about, of you know, how DIT is run on, you know, such bigger productions, because I know some people get very elaborate, you know, it, like you said, some, it goes from as small as just literally backing everything up to then literally color grading on set and doing, you know.
Yeah, it can be a great tool, especially sometimes it's, as you know, like directors and producers, they can really get used to the look of a film just from the dailies, you know. And so it depends how much work and effort you put into the dailies. Like sometimes the biggest contribution now from DATs is creating the LUT files that will establish the look in the dailies and what they're cutting, and And that's, the DP has a little more control then, you know, because it's, I think, depending on the budget, but it's getting less, a bit less rare that DPs are like in a full on sit down DI color session, you know.
Right, gotcha.
That it's, yeah, it's good to kind of put it in there, although you know you're shooting raw or whatever, but at least you know this is what you intended for it to look like, you know.
Yeah. So I'm imagining that sometime at like at this point, what's done more often than not is they kind of do a, like, for lack of a better term, a quick and dirty color grade, right, and then it becomes more refined much later on in the process.
Right, exactly. But at least stay within that world. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I guess, Alonso, tell us, you know, what's next on the agenda? What else do you have going on?
Well, so there's two movies that I just did in August and part of September. I guess we had such a great experience that they want me back for two more. So we're going to go back to Oklahoma in late October through mid-December, and we're going to shoot two more movies. So
amazing, man.
Yeah, it's really exciting. I really, the way 2020 was going, I didn't expect it to be a year where I would shoot four features. But yeah, it's wild. It's exhausting. Like I said, it's a lot of pages a day. And but I really, it's such a good exercise in just getting really fast about figuring out coverage, like, immediately how to compromise very quickly and how to just make the very best decisions in the fastest amount of time. You know, the friends that I still have, that I have that work on those big, big movies and big TV shows, you know, especially the TV shows where they'll, you know, easily do 14, 15 hours a day and they'll go on for 4 or 5 months. They have such grueling schedules, and all they talk about is the DPs who, you know, will camera wrap and will be going straight into a location scout or director scout, you know, that same night. And it feels like we're just getting used to these crazy schedules. And again, because I work in the commercial world for most of the time, I kind of been spoiled by this illusion that you can shoot slower and stuff. But really the stuff that I enjoy doing the most, which is narrative stuff, yeah, it's just become the norm that you have to go very fast. So yeah, I'm excited to be exercising that. And we're shooting those films on Red Helium with Super Speeds, Zeiss Super Speeds, nice. Mark III's, which are, it's a combination that I love. I like the high resolution of the Helium, but the older lenses. So yeah, I'm excited to get back out there.
Do you always strictly shoot on Red?
No, to tell you the truth, I've actually really 90% of what I've shot in the past 5 years has been on Alexa.
Sorry, Alexa.
Alexa, yeah. Mini, you know, probably. I do a lot of Movi stuff as well. Well, we'll be on the Movi for a couple hours in the morning, and then we'll have all the bracketry and stuff to go right on sticks and shoot some interviews and for some of the unscripted commercial stuff I do.
Nice.
Alexa Mini has kind of been the workhorse for us in that sense. But for this one, yeah, knowing that it was film and the producer, the director, and I figured, hey, let's shoot it on 8K and future proof it even further. And yeah, it's been kind of nice to go back to my basics again, because I started with the Red camera. I mean, it's not like I haven't touched a Red camera in years, but yeah, you just get used to the Arri stuff. I've done a few things on the Sony Venice, which I also like, but I really only like using it if there's enough budget and time for a proper color, you know, session at the end of the project. I think it renders amazing images, it's not so quick out of the box like the Alexa Mini. Just looks fantastic immediately. The color science in the Sony, in my mind, is it's not as cinematic, but yeah, once you adjust it a little, it can really be amazing. Nice. So yeah, those are the main cameras I use.
Do you ever have any ambition to move into directing, or do you prefer to stick with cinematography?
No, I do. I it's not that I would want to just transition out of DPing. DPing is probably what I love the most. But there are a few, especially unscripted stuff, I really like kind of figuring stuff out in the moment. And I've shot these little documentary mini docs really for Spotify, where you get a day with an artist and you do a certain activity. And I like that. And I like, in general, interviews and stuff like that. And so, yeah, I'd like to continue on that path and continue shooting for the people that I love working with. And then kind of on the side, maybe 20% of my time will be invested in the directing stuff. But
nice.
Which is something that I think it's getting so much easier, you know, and again, and technology has been demystified, you know, so much to a degree that like a lot of my friends who I shoot for are being asked, especially on the commercial end, like, everybody wants the director to be shooting, you know, which is good for me because it affords me certain opportunities. But I think it's a bit, it's a lot to ask, you know, for all these directors that maybe they were more script driven or kind of more of an actor's director, to all of a sudden understand cameras and lighting and stuff. It's really hard, but,
nice.
So yeah, I'd hopefully, as the future continues, I'll get to keep shooting, DPing for people, and then directing once in a while.
Excellent. We definitely look forward to seeing your work, including these films that you recently did, and which I guess leads me to ask: are you on social media? Where could people sort of follow along?
Yeah, I'm the worst with social media. It's like my biggest enemy.
It's understandable because you're busy doing important things.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I just have a hard time with it. I don't think I've posted anything on Instagram for a while, but I'm gonna start again because I have to, because I've been told it's just I absolutely have to. So yeah, it's my name and last name. So Alonso Holmes, Alonso Holmes.
Cool.
On Instagram. I think it's the one I'm gonna keep.
Nice.
Yeah. Thank you for that.
Well, thank you, Alonso. We really appreciate you being on the Globe Screen podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun. Great chatting with you. And hopefully we'll bump into each other again soon.
Awesome. Thanks, Alonso.
Have a good one. Bye-bye.